I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Lawmakers are cruising through the second half of the legislative session. Both chambers have established their budget numbers and are now trying to work out differences between the two chambers before the session comes to an end next month. We'll check with 90.7's political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry on the latest. Plus, the Florida Film Festival is underway this week. We'll talk with Florida filmmaker Victor Nunez about his recently refurbished film Ruby in Paradise, which is showing at the festival this week. Those conversations ahead on Intersection. And I'm very happy to have 90.7's political analyst Dick Batchelor, former Democratic State House Representative, in the studio.
Thank you. Is that Rubio in Paradise? Is that the film? Rubio in Paradise?
Yeah, that's Marco's first film, I bet. Yeah.
And, of course, former Republican Congressman Lou Fry with us today.
Hi.
And I appreciate you both coming back in for a taping. We had to preempt last week's scheduled airing due to news that WMFE-TV is being sold. But now that we've gotten that out of the way, let's talk some politics. The basics on the budget are Florida facing a $3.7 billion budget gap, just about $4 billion there. Two chambers of the legislature are about $3.3 billion apart in how they're going to resolve this. Anything remarkable about this budget process so far, Dick Batchelor?
What's very remarkable is that they're $3 billion apart, and they're run by the Republican Party. Obviously, as you well know, the House and Senate are run by the Republicans. They have a veto-proof House and Senate. But even the Republicans not negotiating amongst themselves go into the conference committee process over $3 billion apart. The other thing that's, I think, remarkable, might be a strong word, but the lack of involvement, apparent involvement by the governor. I've only seen him testify one time before a committee, but now that the bill's in the conference committee, he had his budget, but the House and Senate budget looked nothing like his. But you'd think he would weigh in and try to negotiate on his own budget behalf, but it's not as apparent that he's involved. So those are the two things that are kind of striking to me.
Still a month and a half left to go, or a month rather left to go. Do you think that he'll show up as we get closer to crunch time?
Well, I would hope. You know, one of the problems he has, this is not a criticism necessarily, he doesn't have any agency heads. You know, usually the budget is written by the agencies. They go to the Office of Planning and Budgeting in the governor's office. He signs off. They go to the legislature. They rewrite them. But at least through the process, the agency heads are there with their staff trying to make a case for their budget. And with that void, with a number of agency heads not in place, I think he's hamstrung, which means that the bottom line is that the strength still will reside with the House and Senate to write the final budget.
Lou Fry?
Which makes him sort of bulletproof. But the other thing is, if I'm one of his staff people, and I know what's going on because it just happens all the time, he's got some staffers up there who's saying, Governor, there's nobody running for president out there. There's at least the number two spot, you know. You got to be strong, and you got to look out so everybody in the country knows you. And on the Wall Street Journal featured some people, and who did they feature? With a big picture of our governor with a quote. It's talking about how you hire people. They've got to be responsible. Big picture of him up there. And, you know, he is getting national attention, and he likes national attention. On the other hand, you look at it from a legislative standpoint and you say, well, Dick and I are sitting there. We have some things we want to do, but let's let the governor run amok. Let's let him get out there, get all the negative press, let the independents basically turn him off on that. It'll make it easier for us to come in and put a budget together. And so I think you have two conflicting political themes going, and I think that's what's happening, actually. I think that he is doing well nationally. He's getting to be known. And yet, on the other hand, I think the members of the legislature have a buffer out there.
Yep. Deep in the numbers, one thing that might get some negative press is there could be education cuts of up to $2 billion. Do you think that's going to mean layoffs for teachers across the state, Lou Fry?
Unless you can find a way to print money. Yeah, it certainly is going to be. And there's other things. There's agencies like planning agencies up there. If you have a big operation like a DRI and so forth, it takes time to go through. But now he's reduced that, I think, from 400 or some hundred people to 30. Yep. You know what that's going to do? That's going to hurt jobs.
Department of Community Affairs.
Yeah, that is going to hurt jobs because if you still have the legislation that you need it, you have it on the books and you can't do it. So instead of increasing the job market in this thing, this is going to be a negative to jobs. And I'm sure there are other things like that when you get below the surface of what's going on.
Dick Batchelor, privatizing prisons under the Senate proposal could save about $1 billion this year. Do you think the governor says he likes privatization? Or are we going to see more private prisons in Florida?
Well, maybe so, but you have to keep in mind, too, they have worked in some states and not others. But also, if you're going to try to create 700,000 new jobs, but then you begin to privatize the state employees, does that mean you've created new jobs, or is it a net-net? And that's what you have to be careful of. But keep in mind, there's one thing they keep banding about in their budget cut. This $1 billion they talk about, they're assuming that the pension reform legislation will go through, and I have no doubt that it will. So they're really counting money that would be saved by requiring state employees to pay someplace between 2 to 5% in their pension plan and higher health care costs. So they're figuring that in. So when you look down to, are they really creating a job? Then I don't know. Sometimes it works, but for-profit prison operations companies have to make a profit. So it depends on how profitable they can be, but if they can reflect an actual cost savings.
Lou Fry,
one of the things that is sort of floating out there, we've got the $38 billion cuts in that, is what's going to happen to the states on some of these unfunded mandates. Mm-hmm. That means there's legislation nationally that requires certain things to be done. But if the federal government doesn't have money for it, who has to do it? The states do. And that may mean in some areas, as Medicare, Medicaid and something, we're not going to have a $4 billion deficit. We may have a $6 or $7 billion deficit. Nobody's talking about that, but that's a fact of life. And I'm worried about it because I think, we all do, Dick and I and you, everybody wants the state to work.
Do you think things are moving faster than normal for a session in Tallahassee, Lufra?
Yeah, that doesn't mean it's bad, but they are moving faster than normal because
you've
got a governor. Well, you have a governor who's very interested in the economic thing, and the rest of it he's written off. I mean, he just doesn't seem to really care about these other issues, and that's certainly a way to govern. I mean, maybe people like it. I would like to see a little more time and thought gone into legislation, but that's probably a strange idea.
What do you think, Dick Batchelor? Are they hurtling quickly to the end here?
They're moving very quickly. They might try to set up a record and get out of the session on time. They'll appoint maybe the conferees sometime later this week, but the only thing they have to do by Constitution, as you well know, is pass the budget. What I worry about is that the fact is you don't have agency heads, as I mentioned before. So sometimes a legislator can say to the staff, write this piece of legislation without weighing sufficiently the consequences of it. At least if you've got some seasoned people, some institutional knowledge, you say, well, we might not want to do it this way. We might want to tweak it this way. But they're doing some things that are very, in my opinion, fairly radical. Reducing the staff, as Lou said, of Department of Community Affairs from 400 to 40, and now you've got a DRI, Development Regional Impact application, and it's got to go through that. Now you've got 10% of the people who were there before, unless the legislature, during the waning days of the session, decides to rewrite the Growth Management Act. Or do away with it,
yeah.
Which means you don't have to apply to DRI. You can have a DRI that can be approved locally or forget about it. So I would expect the last 2 weeks of the session, if you think you've seen something now, wait till it comes out and see what comes out of the woodwork when they wait to the last minute to push some things through, which I intentionally use the term radical.
This was an interesting note last week. The governor issued an executive order reducing the funding for services given to disabled Floridians by 15% effective immediately. Can the governor do that, Lou Fry?
Guess he can. He's done it. So ask forgiveness.
It has happened, but is that
yeah, and
legal?
That really hurts. I've been involved with my wife and Dick has with a thing called Lighthouse Central Florida, which helps kids who have handicaps and both physical and mental handicaps. And one of the people called me and they said, Lou, do you know that we've just been told that we can't get any nursing help for our kids or none of them, and they have nowhere else to go. He said, what are we going to do? And the answer is, I really don't know.
Wouldn't this have to go through some sort of legislative approval, Dick?
Well, the answer is, I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. But the lawsuit has been filed by Sanity Allenbert, former president of the FSU Law School, former president of American Bar Association, somebody Lou knows, and very brilliant lawyer. So he is litigating as to whether or not the governor does have the authority to do that. The problem, you've got two problems. One is the agency spent money it didn't have, which they should not be doing, number one. But number two, how do you take that money back away from the people with disabilities, as Lou talked about, without hurting them? What services will they be denied? You are going to deny services if you rescind that budget. I've talked to other programs locally, Threshold, Quest, and they're saying that the actual cuts are adding up to be 30% to 40%, and they will have to close down some group homes. Now, some of us are members of Final Note when we had these large institutions where we used to warehouse these young people with disabilities, Sunland, for instance, but now we have group homes. What I would hate to see is those services taken away from those young people and the older people, too, who have disabilities and force them back to institutional care. That, number one, is wrong, and number two, it will cost the state more money.
Why do you think it had to be done so quickly? Isn't this something that could have been resolved as the session is going forward and trying to amend the new budget?
Look at the way he's acted. I mean, this is the way he's acted all the way through. I've said it before, ready, fire, aim.
And doesn't it seem kind of random to come out with it?
Yeah.
Just an executive order in that fashion?
Well, yeah, it sure does, and especially something like that, which really impacts people right today as we're talking.
And the legislature's in session, and they've got a budget, but it's a conference committee. They could add the money to this next year's budget and pick up what cost overruns there were. But
that would pick up in July, right?
Well, they could pick it up in July, but the bottom line is, you know, did the agency inappropriately spend money they didn't have? Probably so. But is a solution to basically take services away from those people who are entitled to those services? The answer is no.
We're coming up on Rick Scott's 100 days in office, so I'd love
only
to get,
that long?
Seems a lot longer.
I'd love to get your impressions, although I can see you might be preempting a little here. Dick Batzler, what do you think, 100 days?
He's a tough manager, net to the bottom line, wring out any kind of waste, get the programs in shape. That's good if you're a CFO. But he's a CEO, and every now and then you've got to look at the role as governor and say you have an agenda beyond that. I have no problems with him doing that. Nah. But I think I just don't see the leadership. Let me give you one quick example. Recently, the courts were without money. They're going to have to basically shut down some of the courts in the state of Florida. Charlie Kennedy, who we both know, on the Supreme Court, pled with the governor and said, you've got to extend these funding. We can't just close down the court system in this state. And he agreed to do that. Who made the announcement? Charlie Kennedy on the Supreme Court, an apolitical body. The governor's staff should have had the governor go get a press conference and say the last thing we are going to do is not allow justice to be done. People are going to have access and redress from the courts, and I'm going to find the money, come hell or high water. We're going to fund the courts. No criminals are going to go free, blah, blah, blah. But instead, he missed that opportunity.
Dick, I don't think he – I think what we're looking at is he really doesn't care. He's got his game plan worked out. It worked out when he ran for governor. It worked perfectly in what he did. He's running the state like that. He makes a dictate when something he wants. He goes on to the next thing, lets it be cleaned up. And some of his ideas, I think, are good. But you don't have long enough time to really study them or understand them or see how they fit in. And there's obviously no long-term strategy of where he's going. And I think that's the biggest problem he's got is you can't run the state as a business. The state is not a business. There's three branches of government. People have responsibilities that they've run for and been elected from. They can't turn away from those responsibilities. And he would be so much more effective as a governor if he would work with the different committees up there and with the people with knowledge about what's going on. You know, everybody wants the state to do well. There isn't anybody rooting against the state. So you really give him a pass. He's the only governor we had. He's out there, and he may be doing some good. He may not be doing some good, but you're sort of working for him, and you'd like to say, hey, you know, Scotty, take a deep breath, you know, and slow down, and let's look at where we go from here and what blocks we can build on so that we really have a solid foundation, which I don't think we have now. I don't think there's any foundation right now.
Now, let me interject one thing. I think you can run this state, and I think Lou will agree with this, on business principles.
Yes.
But
definitely.
There's a difference. You know, agencies should be run on business principles. But as a governor, you also have these things, and boy, they really get in your way, called constituencies. And you need to respond to these constituencies, and that's the balance he's got to find.
Well put. That's exactly what I meant. He did a good job, as usual.
I'm your understudy.
Yeah.
Final thoughts there from Dick Batzler, former Democratic State House representative, now heading the Dick Batzler Management Group, and Lou Fry, former Republican member of Congress, now with Lowndes, Drostick, Doster, Cantor, and Reed. Guys, thanks for coming back in.
Thank you.
Brief but good.
Up next, Florida filmmaker Victor Nunez talks about making movies in the Sunshine State. This is Intersection. The Florida Film Festival starts at the end of this week, and this year the festival is celebrating its 20th anniversary with a salute to its native state. One of the artists being featured is Florida filmmaker Victor Nunez. He's a member of the Florida Artist Hall of Fame and is known for films that focus on Florida history and culture. His 1993 film Ruby in Paradise helped launch the career of actress Ashley Judd and was followed up by Yulee's Gold starring Peter Fonda. Ruby in Paradise was recently restored, and the restored version will debut April 16th at the Florida Film Festival. Victor Nunez, welcome to Intersection.
Hi, thanks. It's good to be here.
Now, you've made many different films dating back to the 1970s. Ruby in Paradise came out in 1993, so I'm curious about why you decided to restore Ruby in Paradise over some of your other films.
Well, it was just next in line. We actually have restored both Gal Youngin and, excuse me, A Flash of Green. I guess we were sort of doing this in order. IFC did supervise those restorations, and at present, the only place that I know of that those can be seen is on iTunes. But Ruby, at this point, the first and only time that we know anything is going to happen is it's going to be screened at the festival. After that, I still have control of it, and it's the last film that I still owned. And so Yulee and Coastlines, I believe, have already entered the digital realm.
So was there something wrong with the film? Was it degrading over time?
It was just all the films, as time passes, the technology improves, the state of the blow-up process when these films came out was somewhat limited. We went back to the camera originals and scanned them at a lab, Goldcrest Labs in New York, Goldcrest Post. They have the state-of-the-art equipment, and it was amazing to see these films better than they have ever been. Ruby is just stunning. Kodak film was amazing and still is.
So what you're talking about, right, is that this film was shot on 16 millimeter, if that's correct, and the standard film size is different, right?
35, yeah. All I've always worked in Super 16. It's a format that I've always felt very comfortable. A good mix of high standard of image and small package and economical. And yes, traditionally they would all be blown up to 35 millimeter for theatrical release. And at this point, the way that films can be enlarged is much more rigorous and a lot more information gets pulled from the film.
Well, we've got a clip from the trailer of Ruby in Paradise, so let's just listen to that for a second. This is actress Ashley Judd.
Well, I could do just about anything right here. I bet it looks like it's
pretty good.
Are you sure? Because there are plenty of people in here. I'm sure that you could just add me right in, and I could do something just fine for you.
So Ashley Judd there, trying to get a job in the film. Who is Ruby?
Ruby, what was interesting, I had not really visited the film for a long, long time, and watching the movie during the restoration, I was struck with, I don't want to say timely, but how universal some of these issues. She's a young woman who is running away from a bad situation in Tennessee. She has a memory, a childhood memory of a visit to Panama City Beach. And so she just heads south. When we were talking, at the time we made it, if she hadn't put the brakes on, she would have just driven right onto the Gulf of Mexico. And she tries to begin to put her life together and figure things out. She keeps a journal, and she sort of tries to find her place in the world.
And tell me about the role that Florida plays in that film. You mentioned she's coming back to find some sort of lost memory, but really Florida, the people she encounters, the environment, this is a theme throughout all your films. How do you think it's unique to this one?
Well, what I have always been struck by, having grown up in Florida, is that all of us who are some form of native, we live in a state that is also, for so many visitors, this paradise moment, a vacation, an escape from things. And so what intrigued me with Ruby was that she was somebody who was moving here for that myth, but she was also going to be encountering the reality of it's just a place where people try to live. And I love that about Florida. It has been part of all the films that I've made here.
Victor, tell us about the kind of reception that Ruby in Paradise received when it came out in 1993.
Well, it was it seemed like the film gods were aligned with the movie. We co-won the Sundance Film Festival Best Picture Award. I may not consider it my best film. I'm not sure. I never can really say that. But in many ways, watching it, it's the purest one that I got to be part of.
Why is it the most pure?
I think because there had been a while since I made it, and it was sort of there was nothing to lose in the making of this movie, and so there was sort of. It wasn't that it was compromise or not compromise. It's not the issue as much as it just fell together in a very natural way, it just all made sense in itself, if that makes sense to anybody.
I read that you were actually born not far from Orlando in DeLand, and that you grew up
That's
in Tallahassee
right.
and split your time between there and Peru. How did those experiences influence your making of films and your film career?
Yeah. Well, actually, I was just born in DeLand. I grew up, I went to school in first grade in Lakeland, and I lived for a while in Plant City. And, you know, my mom was a teacher. And I think what always fascinated me, actually, the thing that drew me to making films about this is when I was in college and I sort of discovered Southern literature at the same time that I discovered film. And at that time, back in the 60s, these were European films, and they were films about people in very specific places, unlike the sort of Hollywood myth of great palaces and forts, et cetera. It seemed like real people were having real experiences in a real place. And it just struck me that, you know, why can't there be such a thing as a Southern filmmaker, just like there were Southern writers? And I guess I've spent my life either proving that it is possible or that it's not such a great idea. So there you go.
What do you think are the hallmarks of maybe Southern writing and Southern filmmaking? What are the parallels between the two?
Well, there are not too many examples of Southern filmmaking per se, but I think what I just said about what drew me to... If I had to pick a specific word, it's that people are concerned about their souls. And I don't mean that necessarily in a religious sense, but they care about trying to figure out their relationship to their world, to those they love and know, and to their work. And they're trying to make sense of things in a way that I think sometimes is not sort of addressed in some of the others where everything is very present-oriented. I should quickly add, I'm not sure that the South is the South anymore in that regard. One of the things that was fascinating also about watching Ruby recently is that when I wrote the script, I was writing a script about a place that I felt had no past, you know, that's part of the coast, part of the mythology, the other side of the Florida experience. And so here was somebody who was leaving a world and leaving a past and trying to deal with something that's was just strictly in the present. It seems like what's happened to us culturally since the film was made is we're even more that way. It's sort of interesting watching where we're heading. I'm not sure how thin the present moment can be before we start sort of getting frayed around the edges.
Do you feel like in your films you try to focus on areas of Florida that maybe the general public doesn't really know about, maybe even Floridians don't really know about? You know, at Yulee's Gold, you're up in the Panhandle, which to many people that you talk about Tallahassee, they think you're talking about Mars or something.
Well, Florida's forgotten coast. That's the way the realtors were selling it for decades. By now, all you have to do is drive over to Destin, and I think anybody from South Florida will feel right at home. whether that's good or bad, I'm not sure. This is not a mission. It's about finding interesting stories and people It was interesting when I went to Panama City to scout and try to, we had an incredibly small budget on this film, and I would tell people, they would say, what are you doing here? Why are you making this movie? And I said, it's about a young girl trying to find a new life in Panama City and leaving a bad experience. And there would be a pause, and it didn't matter whether it was the person at the motel check, registration, or the gas pump, or the donut vendor, or they would say, well, that's my story. And I think that this dream or myth of it being a place for a new start, and sort of where that dream sometimes hits the ground of reality, that's not just restricted to that part of Florida. I just happen to be there. I know the last time I visited Miami, and my goodness, Miami's been covered a million times, but it was sunset in some sort of little worn down part of the city, and I thought, wow, this is beautiful. There ought to be a movie here. And unfortunately, the story didn't come to mind, or I would have tried to pursue that.
I've heard that you're working on a project now about Ybor City, and that you actually aren't going to be able to shoot too many scenes there. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's Galyang, and I keep going back to that, was set in 1931, Depression era, Prohibition era, Florida. To shoot it, we basically had to restore one farmhouse and a country store and a few little odds and ends, and then have people come through these things. It was about a bootlegger living off of a widow's income out in the woods. El Lector is about the readers of Ybor City in the same era, 1931, but it's set in the community of Ybor City and requires hundreds of extras, and it's very, very much a producer's picture, and the producers who are based both in New York and London are looking everywhere, including Argentina, and because unfortunately Ybor City, in some miscalculated sense of urban renewal, was pretty much just done in back in, I believe, the late 60s, early 70s. And so it would be very difficult to shoot this story there.
So
it is ironic because there is a Florida story and a wonderful, very unique, specific part, something that I actually did not know very much about until beginning this adaptation. It's based on a wonderful, actually a juvenile book called El Lector, and it's a relationship of a reader and his granddaughter who dreams of one day becoming a reader herself.
Well, Victor Nunez, you are going to be down in the Orlando area when your film is debuting April 16th at the Florida Film Festival. It's the 1993 film Ruby in Paradise, recently restored, and they'll be debuting that restored version at the Florida Film Festival. Victor Nunez, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You can listen to this episode and previous programs at WMFE.org/intersection. Share your comments at the WMFE Facebook and Twitter pages or on the Florida Talks blog, all linked online. You can also send email to intersection@WMFE.org. Support for this program comes from our listeners and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.